Hello and thank you for joining me as I reflect upon my new book, Insurrection, and compare it and contrast it with my first book, How Not to Speak of God. In order to accomplish this, I want to take 5 short sessions looking at the first section of How Not to Speak of God, and then using the remainder of the sessions to look at each chapter of Insurrection. In many ways, the first 5 sessions then are a type of retrospective on my first book. If you want to remove a mountaintop, you first have to dig holes into the mountain and plant explosives, and then you set those explosives off. In many ways, I see How Not to Speak of God as the act of drilling those holes deep into the mountain of religion, and I see Insurrection as the setting off of those explosions. So let's begin with the drilling of the holes. How Not to Speak of God, in many ways, revolves around a problem. And the problem is, how do we speak of God? In the introduction, I start by saying that many believers feel a real desire to speak about that which is most precious to them, that which has transformed their lives, that which they feel has liberated them. And yet, that has to be contrasted with this other concern, that every time we speak of that source, that place of liberation, we somehow do it an injustice, that our words are always inappropriate, that at their best they point towards something, and at their worst they eclipse it and encrust it and prevent people from actually experiencing that source for themselves. And so the believer feels that they must speak, and yet also that they must somehow remain silent. This means that theology is analogous in some ways to poetry, because poetry at its best tries to express something that in many ways always slips out of language. Speaking of love, of desire, of loss, of death, of birth, all of these are experiences that mark us, and yet are experiences that we find difficult to put into language and to express. So poetry is a form of speaking that also remains silent. It's a form of words that speak of that which is beyond words. It offers a language at the very limits of language, a language that critiques language and draws out its limitations. Poetry is also a discourse that comes after an event. It's a way of trying to speak of something that's happened, something that has taken place. It is a testimony, a witness to something. In the same way, theology comes in the aftermath of an event. It tries to speak of something that has happened, that has taken place. And this is why the first part of How Not to Speak of God begins by saying that faith is born in the aftermath of God. It is fanned into life in the wake of what we believe to have been the incoming of a life-giving encounter in which we feel connected with and transformed by the source of everything that is. It is then a conversation that comes too late, that arrives after the fact, like the police after a crime. Something has taken place, we can't deny it, and yet all we have are glimpses, guesses at what happened. In light of this, How Not to Speak of God begins by reflecting on the event of God as a type of trauma. A trauma is something that happens to us, that we cannot deny, but that we cannot quite put into language. Take the example of someone in court case who said that they've been abused. If they're able to give a very coherent account about what happened, the dates and the times, who was there, what they saw, then that's not evidence they're telling the truth. that's actually evidence that they are lying. In contrast, if someone stands up in court saying that they've been abused, and actually the times that they give and the dates that they give don't quite work, that maybe they contradict an earlier testimony or even contradict themselves in the stand, that isn't evidence that they're lying. That's actually evidence that they're telling the truth. Why? Well, because a trauma is something that so affects us, that transforms us, that influences and impacts us, but kind of short circuits our mind. We cannot fully bring it into our cognition. We always, when we're speaking of a trauma, find ourselves at a loss. When one speaks of God, one speaks of a traumatic event, of something that has happened, the incoming of something that affects us and transforms us, but that we cannot fully understand or articulate. This is how we can understand the claim in chapter 1 that revelation is a form of concealment. Because if revelation is a form of trauma, it is analogous to looking at the sun and being blinded. There is so much given to us that we are short-circuited. It's like we are a ship sunken in the very depths of the ocean. While the ocean contains the ship, and the ship contains the ocean contains the entire ship, while the ship contains but a fragment of the ocean. This can help us understand what is perhaps the central analogy of the first chapter, which can be found on page 16. And it's that of a person going into an art gallery and looking at a beautiful painting. We can say that the painting is a type of revelation because it's given, there is something there. But a great piece of art can't be reduced to a single interpretation. We don't just look at it once and then leave and never have to return. As we look at a piece of art, it speaks to us in different ways as we engage with it. In many ways, the Christian tradition is like a painting of an event. It is a painting full of vibrant colours. And yet, if we come to that tradition and we try to work out what exactly it says, and we try to reduce it to a singular meaning, we do an injustice to that tradition. Instead, like someone who loves a piece of art, we must return again and again to that tradition, engage with it, dialogue with it, learn from it, and discover that it will speak to us in ever new ways as we come to it in different places, at different times, as we bring different things to it. Make no sense for some people who loved art to come in and say this piece of art has one meaning and this is it, and then to set up little sects around that meaning and battle with people who have different interpretations. True, people will have their interpretations, and true, we will discuss them and debate them. But what is most important is that we love that tradition, that we are transformed by it, that we want to interact with it. It's not that the tradition has no meaning, it's that it has so much meaning. We are overwhelmed by meaning. But unlike the painting in an art gallery, this is a living tradition. We are not simply invited to dialogue with it, to interpret it. We're invited to participate in it and to become part of its evolving and transforming nature. We are part of a conversation that has gone on for millennia and will no doubt go on for millennia still. Hence the chapter ends with that famous prayer of Meister Eckhart, "I pray, God, rid me of God." For Meister Eckhart understood that every time we say the word God, every time we write down our theology, every time we try to capture the source of our faith, we say less than God. We speak of less than that source. We have to speak, and yet we must remind ourselves that our speech is limited, because what we speak of is nothing less than an earth-shattering, life-transforming trauma.